Hey everyone, if you want to support the ongoing writers and actors strike, go to entertainmentcommunityfund.org and make sure your donation is designated to film and television. This isn't a strike fund. It is for those who are hurt by the AMPTP's actions that caused the strike. Everything made in the world of film and television would not be what they are without these talented individuals. We at Renegade Animation and Renegade Pop Culture stand with the ongoing strikes. With all that said, if you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, and a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. We are everywhere. Also, support our Patreon. That way we can keep doing what we love, and that's talking about metal, metal, and more metal. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host for this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And joining us for this episode, we've got my jukebox co-host, Nick.
Back, baby! Dr. Rexo, the rock and roll clown! Patrick Cocaine!
So this is our second Metalocalypse-themed podcast. Before, Nick and I, for Jukebox, did Why We Love This Band, covering Death Clock, and naturally, we had to follow this up with the direct-to-video feature, Army of the Doomstar. Now, before we really get into the weeds of things, Cameron, since you were not on the Jukebox episode, I want your general thoughts on the series so far.
Metalocalypse is interesting. It came out during that time, during the later half of the 2000s, where edgy, nihilistic, and violence were the name of the games. It was in our horror movies, it was in our adult comedies, and every adult animated comedy was still trying to catch that high of either being Family Guy or South Park in terms of shock value. Metalocalypse, for the most part, rose to the top of those types of adult comedies of that time period because they weren't trying to be a Family Guy killer or anything like that. It was Brendan Smalls, the guy who created Home Movies, and his team were just doing this fun little show about a metal band that was one of the biggest economies in that show's world, getting into horrific and violent shenanigans. All because you can be the biggest metal band in the world, or just the biggest band in the world in general, and still not be the brightest bulbs in the kitchen. Let's just say that. I think what helps with a lot of this show is that a lot of the jokes come at the expense of the band members themselves. I mean, yeah, granted, a lot of people horrifically die in this show throughout its four seasons, one special, and a movie. But they don't blame it on anyone else but the band. Even their manager, everyone who works for the band is aware of their incompetence. I think my favorite reoccurring gag is just how nonchalant and passive-aggressive the doctor is towards the band members. Because he'll just be like, okay, you know what, whatever, you're not paying attention. Or during the episode where they got a cold, he's just like, just get into a sauna and sweat it out. Idiots! Because they just don't know how to function outside of making metal. I do think there are a few episodes that don't hold up. Like the one where they adopt a kid. I think it was called like Diversity Clock episode. I don't quite get where they were going with that episode. But in terms of these edgy adult comedies, it still holds up pretty well. It doesn't have a lot of the same early season issues that like Venture Brothers had or were just not funny. This show is funny. I think my favorite episode is still the season one episode where they summon a troll. I think that's like the perfect episode to show people of just how the band members work off of one another in their dynamic with their manager, the secret organization that's following them. And even though the later seasons had better animation, there are just some fun visual moments of that one episode. I think everything with the Death Phones was consistently funny. I think my biggest issue with the show was a consistency between the band members and their personalities as they went on with the seasons. Because sometimes they would be on point, wholly aware of the situation, and they knew how to do certain things outside of playing music. I think when they learned that other season one episode where they learned the blues is another highlight of when they were looking over the contract with the devil. And then there's just like, the devil guys, I need to go to my notary. And then Murderface is like, well, I'm a notary. Sometimes they would just be the dumbest bag of hammers. I don't quite, like, I found it kind of frustrating at points because they would have all this lore and character development, and then they would just kind of drop it until we get to season 3 and 4, where they start to cement the individual personalities. Like, Murderface is the Ringo of the band because he is the least talented and the least creative individual. The brother-like dynamic between Squizgar and Toki was always kind of fun. A little mean-spirited from season 2, but they got better by season 3. And how Nathan and Pickles were pretty much the parents of the band, making sure everything went well and to shoot down any of the nonsense brought upon one of Murderface's schemes. It was a real bummer that the show got canceled right after that cliffhanger of Toki getting kidnapped. I'm glad we got that special, even though it took me 2 watches to actually fully enjoy it. But I did like it the second time around and found myself seeing why I like this show.
Yeah, I was actually just going to say, I mentioned this, I don't know if you listened to the Why We Love This Band on Death Clock, but I think one of the issues with Doomstar Requiem really was just the lack of promotion behind it, because like I remember back in the day just kind of going like, I'm not seeing any ads for this at all. Like, I didn't see any ads, I didn't see any promo, just other than here's the release date, here's when the soundtrack for it comes out, boom, that's your special.
I'm pretty sure it took me until the single for that special was released before I knew that it was even coming.
Adult Swim really screwed this entire special over.
I think that was at the time where they were going through a changing of the guards, and unfortunately that changing came in the form of canceling Metalocalypse, and it's like, fine, we'll give you enough money to solve this plot line, but only this plot line, and it's only going to be like an hour long. And in general, though, it was just like, I like their dynamics, but sometimes I did not believe that they actually cared for one another, only because there were moments where one episode was like, they were all be on the same page, and then the next episode, they'd be entirely dysfunctional. And knowing how they were partially maybe based off of Metallica during the Saint Anger era of the band, it makes a lot more sense. That's kind of something that will go into one of my small gripes with the movie, but overall, if you had to be a violent, edgy adult comedy from the mid to late 2000s, you could do worse than Metalocalypse. And at least Metalocalypse had like the cool visuals. It was very distinct for a show from that time period. If I had to pick, I guess like 3 of my favorite songs from Metalocalypse, even though I'm not the biggest metal fan. I like Mermaider, the first one. I like Bloodlines. And I think it's called Sky Slayer, the one that plays in the episode where Pickles goes to rehab.
Oh, Sky Hunter.
Yeah, Sky Hunter. And maybe it's just because I have a narrow view of what I think of metal, or at least this kind of metal, death metal. That one sounded more to me kind of like power metal, especially with that opening riff from with the guitar and such. Like, I'm not
melodic
like,
death metal does a lot of that, where it is like pretty melody based, but it still stays heavy.
A good example of what both of you are describing is a band called Children of Bodom. They are pretty much like as melodic as you can get while still being death metal.
Like, it was a very distinct show. It was basically like Adult Swim saying, hey, we could possibly use this to make our own version of the Gorillaz. And I mean, that's kind of like what they are. I went to one Metalocalypse concert, and that was, maybe 2008 or so. It was still when I was in high school. And let's just say I was not used to going to a death metal concert. So having to sit through Chimera and Soylent Green before we got to the band was a bit of a chore.
I'm a big Chimera fan, so I'm like, I would have loved to have seen that.
I mean, that, like, I can respect the talent and the work that goes into death metal, but I was there for Metalocalypse, or Death Clock in this case, and I just found myself a little drained having to listen to two bands before that. Though it was all made up for it with the commentary from the band members themselves, and then, of course, they did the whole, okay, before we leave, we're going to play one more song. And then they played the fan song, which is also probably one of my favorite songs from the early side of the show. It's just such a fun song to listen to. I think why Metalocalypse works also is while they are a parody band in some regards, they're more a homage parody band instead of like a Weird Al version of like metal, if that makes sense. I we talked about this the other week, and
yeah, they described the show as like both a parody and a pastiche of metal culture at large.
Before WBD and David Zaslav just burned the entire company to the ground, it was shocking to hear that they were going to make direct-to-video movies for some of their Adult Swim shows with last year's Aqua Teen Hunger Force, this year's Venture Brothers, and a Metalocalypse film to tie everything up. And I was curious to see how I was going to feel about this show and this movie going into it. To jumpstart us to talk about the movie, I thought it did a pretty good job. I still have some complaints, but they're mostly extremely minor complaints. But in general, you got what you wanted with a Metalocalypse finale.
I find little to disagree with there. Cool if I just give everybody the quick rundown of like just the plot of the movie. Just
go ahead.
So basically, it's picking straight up right after the Doomstar Requiem. Toki's rescued. Magnus is killed by the Doomstar, the masked assassin killed by the Doomstar and the band. Deathclock decides to go on a press conference to announce a new album, new tour. And I just gotta say, the way they introduced the band, that's just perfect. Murderface telling all the fans to go fuck themselves. Brilliant. But basically, Nathan is the only one who remembers what happened throughout the entire special. Everybody just all of a sudden gets amnesia, doesn't remember what happens. Even Abigail doesn't remember what happened. And Nathan is just like, this is all fucked up. I can't do this anymore. And he basically just becomes a total recluse on Xanax. So eventually he's told, no, you have to go write the Song of Salvation. And pretty much the majority of the movie is just them trying to figure out what the song is supposed to be.
As far as the plot goes, I couldn't have asked for anything better and more suited for these characters.
Given we had to wait 10 years for it, and just there were petitions to even get it made in the first place, it gives you what you want, but it still does it on its own terms, which I like about it a lot.
I will say my criticism of how much the bandmates actually cared for one another honestly kind of picks back up from Doomstar Requiem to the movie, because I don't quite believe that they still like each other going into the movie, because the only reason they went to save Toki was because the fans were going to revolt against them. So instead of being like, hey, we got to save Toki, but we're only doing it because this could hurt our record sales, even though, granted, they use that as a punchline early on in the show's run where Charles is like, I didn't want to say anything, but this is hurting your record sales. There, I said it. And then they're just like, man, way to bring the room down, Charles.
Like, I'm actually going to say I'm perfectly okay with it because, I mean, if just to kind of give a, we're obviously going to talk about spoilers and everything. With that aspect, I'm perfectly okay with it because most of the movie is about the band's relationship with their fans and not just Nathan and Abigail. It's him coming to terms with them having fans that, you know, are this obsessive over them. So I'm pretty okay with that and everything. And even John Hamm's amazing cameo in this movie says, oh yeah, this was totally because the fans asked for it.
Don't you think there's a bit of meta commentary in there too? Because, you know, this movie has been like a decade in the making. And
that's why I love that first 5 minutes. It's, you know, they're like, hey, the fans basically brought this back and Murderface is telling us all to go fuck ourselves. So this is basically what we ask for.
And then John Hamm's character was just like, so when are we going to get a new album? And then Nathan and Pickles are like, yeah, here we go. My original criticism was going from Doomstar to the movie was I don't fully believe it, but then you watch the movie and it's like, okay, they're actually working on it. I don't think they quite go far enough with some of it, but it was mostly about the band's, like you said, the dynamic with the fans. And to be this mix of horror, metal, epic, fantasy, action stuff, and just this cool mix of death metal and, at least for the show, fairly complex character moments. Like, I know I'm kind of opening over criticisms, but I just want to get them out of the way because they're so minor. I don't think it hurts the movie fully. I wish they had at least a moment for Toki and Squizgar to either make amends or to kind of wrap up their dynamic. I mean, I guess they do. It's just that Squizgar is always going to be the punk brother of the bunch. Like, he likes to poke fun and punch at Toki, even though Toki's kind of like the younger brother of the two. And I just wish there was a little more of that dynamic, or at least have a moment where Squizgar's just like, hey, I haven't really said anything about this, but I'm glad you're back, or something like that. But I do like the small moments that they do have where, like, Toki is very protective of Squizgar when the whole attack happens and is supportive of him, even though Squizgar has been on multiple occasions not a great person towards Toki, especially during season two and what have you. But I think what I like about this, I watched the behind the scenes thing for this movie, and Brendan knew going in that they had to push the story first. Like, they just couldn't do 90 minutes of Metalocalypse shenanigans. They had to push the story forward, which I like, and it shows that Metalocalypse can actually work with a plot.
See, I'm going to kind of piggyback off of one thing with Squizgar and Toki. That's actually one of my own issues with the movie. There is a severe lack of Toki in this movie. And, like, we already spent an entire special with a lack of him. Obviously, for story purposes, he's kidnapped. I get it. Here, is it just me or some scenes he's basically not even present? Like, he's drawn on screen, but he just doesn't say very much.
I don't know if he really gets, like, spotlight moments, except for maybe
except when he... for the church. Except for getting his devil teddy bear with his guitar and losing the teddy bear at the end of the movie and finding it again.
Yeah.
Murderface gets more of a story arc in this movie.
He does.
But Murderface also was part of the cliffhanger from Doomstar, though.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's just like, So Murderface gets one, but they don't really linger on Toki. I assume they just thought, hey, we had a whole special about trying to rescue Toki. It's not really his story anymore. It's more mostly the band, but it's mostly Nathan's coming to terms with being this chosen one band and whatnot, and have this power from the fandom and such. I do think there's a lack of Toki. Like, I try to bring up those moments saying at the end, not ruining the movie, but there could have been more, or at least some time taken for the band to reconcile with what happened from the special, because they don't really do that. They just move on ahead because of they were only going to get this one movie.
One thing I have to ask, do you think part of the reason why we didn't get as much time for these character moments is because a lot of these direct-to-video movies only get like a limited amount of time? If this was like a theatrical film that was 10 or 15 minutes longer, I bet we would have had a little bit more breathing room, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm actually looking it up right now. It looks like Aqua Teen Hunger Force's movie was only like an hour and 15 minutes long, and then the Venture Brothers movie was barely under an hour and a half. But yeah, I do have to agree with that. It's not so much a criticism as much as it is like maybe an extra 10 or 15 minutes could have benefited it.
It's just the tough spot that these movies are in, because at the very least, I get why Aqua Teen was only 76 minutes. Aqua Teen does not hold itself for a full 90 minutes or more.
Oh, especially because I did watch that first Aqua Teen movie about a month ago, and yeah, it does not hold itself very well to a plot, so I'll agree with you there.
At least with Venture Bros and Metalocalypse, they had more plot to work off of. But it's a bummer because they start with the press conference, and then they montage through a bunch of time where Nathan is dealing with a lot of PTSD from the incident from the special. And then they go into like, okay, we got to go to this monastery to write the Song of Salvation.
Actually, the funeral for the old priest of the Black Lock.
Right, right. And then when we get there, we spend a lot of time there. And I mean, like, I like seeing Nubler. I like seeing him back, even though they don't really give an explanation as to why he's there. But
because he's the band's producer, that's why.
He's their Bob Rock.
No, he's their Phil Spector, if anything.
Right.
And we only get like one appearance from Dr. Rock, so does he die? Like, did he die? Because I feel like that was just like, here's a fun little Dr. Rock so moment, and then they had to keep the plot moving because they had to have him in there for the sake of the fans.
I don't think he dies. I do wish they would have shown him at the battle at the end of the movie for like a couple seconds helping Toki out at least, but that introduction scene for Dr. Roxo was just, that was beautiful.
I love that scene, but I do have to agree, seeing him in the final battle would have given Toki a moment to shine, if nothing else.
Well, exactly. They had enough time to put the chef and the kid that they adopted into the opening shot of the battle, but they didn't have time to put Dr. Roxo in to help Toki or something. Even Murderface, again, gets more to do in that, where he's the one who throws the figurative and literal snowball for Vader Orlog's death. And we don't even get Charles that much.
To be fair, though, he does go off to be the priest of the Church of the Black Lock. So, like, I can excuse Offenson not being in this as much. And even at the towards the end of Doomstar Requiem, he did say that they kind of need to just go and you know, kind of take care of themselves from here, and he doesn't want to put them in more danger than they're already in.
That's fair. I just like his character, and then felt like he, I guess to use a fighting game term, nerfed. Like, you're telling me you couldn't take care of that whatever Vader Orlog was, the old man?
The more mystery around Orlog, the better, because, like, the fact that A, he's voiced by Malcolm McDowell adds cool factor, and then B, just the fact that he can probably fuck you up too, just adds to kind of the cool factor. So I can kind of buy that, though. At least it gives them an excuse to have a really cool fight at the end of the movie.
Yes. Oh,
it's a very fun fight. The animation for this movie looks great, and it was definitely a bad idea to go from the movie back to season one just to watch the Lake Troll episode. Boy, howdy, was that first season rough. And it got better, but you can see where Flash animation was back then, where they had these highly detailed characters, but they moved everything. I think they were on motion tweens.
Nick, how much did you say the budget was for season one?
I have no clue off the top of my head. I just remember Brendan Small saying in an interview just to promote the movie that they basically asked, like, hey, what's the cheapest show on Adult Swim? And can we get a budget lower than that even?
Yeah, we've definitely come a long way since then.
Oof. Which is interesting because they do a lot of detailed character designs and a lot of graphic deaths. And you could tell by the third season, they got a little more money into the budget. And this one, it just looks great. All the lighting, the atmosphere, the details, the backgrounds and environments, the cinematography, they make it feel big.
Yeah, I was actually just going to bring that up at some point. I couldn't help but go on my watch this movie three times to prepare for this. So I was just going, man, this just looks amazing. The animation, the detail, just even the hair, noticing how the hair was moving and how fluid it looked. That was great. And yeah, I'll give you that. It has come a long way since that first season. Another thing that I was kind of surprised by that I totally wasn't even expecting watching this, there was a lot more General Crozier in this movie than I was expecting.
Yeah, and it's nice that he gets a bit of redemption after everything that he's been through since the end of season one.
From him trying to let his family know, like, hi, I'm sorry I played a role in the end of the world. I am sorry if you do not see me again. These are my final words. And then Orlog's just like, not happening, and kills the guy that tried to give his family the note. Like, that was pretty great. And then, like, even him getting a chance to help the band trying to defeat Salacia. I mean, the fact that he just gets even more of a character surprised me in this movie.
This movie does a good job in general with wrapping a lot of the plot points up or giving people satisfying arcs. Like, Edgar John Frew unfortunately dies in the end, but he does help General Crozier with destroying that big mechanical thing. Maybe it's just because they saved a lot of the gore for the end, and of course for the Song of Death. This might be the least violent piece of Metalocalypse, maybe next to Death Star Requiem. Like, for a show that's like known for its hyperviolence, not as much as like Super Jail, which came out around the same time. But it was interesting to watch this movie and to see all of the more edgy, nihilistic moments of the franchise downplayed. And I like that. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It was just an observation of there aren't a lot of people getting killed until the first song plays and then the battle at the end happens.
Yeah, it's not something I really noticed until you pointed it out, but yeah, come to think of it, it is probably the least violent Metalocalypse content you could watch. The other thing, too, since you brought up Edgar dying in the movie, holy shit, does this actually have the balls to kill characters off? I'm gonna spoil this one. Nubler dies.
That yeah. was actually kind of sad. Like, honestly.
Oh, I was just taken aback. I was like, you're actually going to kill off a major character? What? And at the same time, it also makes the most sense because, I mean, he was technically working for the Tribunal in season one when they were recording Death Water. So maybe this was his kind of a way of redemption, especially helping the band record all this music together. So I was like, okay, this makes sense story-wise, but it's also still like, holy shit, you're actually going ahead with this moment.
Kudos to the movie for actually killing some major characters off.
Yeah, no, it was very impressive. I mean, we knew this was going to be the closing finale to the show, but you know, you always get that sense of they're going to leave it open enough to maybe start another season or series or get another movie. But instead of that, they just make sure to close up any lingering plot details. Like Senator, how do you say his name?
Stampingston.
Yeah, Stampingston. Like, what was he supposed to gain out of all that? Like, was he just like, hey, I'm going to get unlimited power, and then he turns into a giant meat balloon and pops?
It's the same thing as Orlog. I just think that Salacia just somehow convinced them to go along with all of this.
I mean, he was a background player with making sure political power moves were made to be in favor of Salacia. And man, Mark Hamill. Dude can play a creepy individual.
He can.
Especially the scenes with him trying to possess Murderface. Like, that is something straight out of any 70s horror movie where a character is about to get possessed. It's super well animated, super creepy and atmospheric, but just looks awesome.
It was very creepy. Like, part of me kind of wished we could save this movie for a Halloween episode, only because they venture into horror quite a bit with this movie. I mean, not to say that you'll like jump out of your seat screaming or anything like that, but the moody atmosphere that they put into those scenes, like, it was impressive because I would assume metal and horror have a sort of friendship between the two.
There is a Venn diagram of metal fans and horror fans. Like,
oh, definitely. Wednesday 13, Necrophagia, just two bands that are just coming straight off the tip of my tongue right now.
I'm still amazed about how this movie had, and the show in general, had such a small cast because of, well, obvious budget limitations. But just how diverse and with the creators are for the characters and their voices. One thing that I will say about like the current ongoing Futurama revival, the newest revival, you can tell that the actors got older and that it's that Simpsons dilemma where some of the character voices are sounding a little too old or to sound like heck on the vocal cords of the voice actors in question.
At 100%, man.
But Brendan Small and Tommy Blanca?
Yeah, that sounds right.
They feel like they haven't skipped a beat with Nathan, Squizgar, Pickles, Toki, and William. They all sound like how they did 10 years ago.
It's incredible how easily Small and Blanca just slipped right back into these characters.
Part of me kind of wishes we had a little more time for the council to bamf around a little. I forgot how much I love the moments where they are talk about like what the band's up to for that episode.
One thing I am actually going to say about the voice acting, I do kind of wish they gave a lot of the metal and hard rock royalty that they got to be in this movie a bit more to do rather than just basically be fans in the background.
I think the only one that actually has, like, it's still a small role, but a meatier role is King Diamond, is the priest at the funeral.
At the church and the funeral.
Yeah.
If you're getting Amy Lee, you would think you would get her to do a bit more than just scream that Nathan is a god. And then Scott Ian doesn't really do that much in the movie either. I don't know where Kirk Hammett is in any of this.
I think I spotted Kirk, but I'd have to go through it again and hear his voice. But yeah, no, it was weird. I think that's what I was going into this expecting, that they were going to get hard rock or metal members of that community and scene to play bigger roles in the movie, but they really didn't. Maybe they didn't have the budget for it.
I do get it that it really is Nathan's movie, and the fact that he carries this movie as well as he does is awesome. Like, he's carrying this movie about... I was gonna say he carries this movie about as well as he does those buckets of water up that giant cliff, but that would imply that he doesn't do it that well at all. So I don't know where the hell I was going with that.
I get what you're saying. You don't think he would be able to carry an entire story arc for 90 minutes, but they find a way to keep the characters interesting. I'm a little bummed that Murderface doesn't get a better conclusion with his arc. It's just like, what's my point in the band? Instead of just them being like, hey, you're our bass player, we need you. They just say like, hey, your job is to suck. I mean, I get he's the bass player, and I know they have to have that one band member to punch down on. But I don't know. I guess, but granted, when you see Murderface throughout the whole show, finding out his goal and his place in the band is to suck is about as good as he's going to get it.
It's almost a backhanded compliment, but in the sphere of the show, it makes a lot of sense.
I get where you're coming from, Cameron, but I do have to say, at least Pickles has the nerve to just be like, no, you're the voice of dissent. And then everybody just proceeds to be like, no, you suck. And Toki's like, you suck so much, you sucks the souls right out to me's.
Like, it was interesting to see what band members got more focused than not. Pickles was just there to essentially keep everything together. He was the band mom, as they would say. And it's interesting to see him, out of all the characters, alongside Nathan, be the most responsible. Even though throughout the whole show, he is the one who's prone the most to
doing aggressive all of amounts the drugs.
The drugs, the alcohol, and to just kind of snap at everything. But to see him be the one to end up being the glue for the whole band to stick together was a good ending to his character. Because there are sometimes some of those episodes in the show where I was just like, how is he not dead?
Exactly.
Especially that one where he gets the PR manager who is actually running a cult, but is just using Pickles for a means to an end. And then that whole, I love that whole dynamic where they're just like, we want a PR manager. And Charles is like, I am your manager. Yeah, but we want a fun one. I am. And then just how he's like, ah, deep breath. You're dealing with giant children. It's okay. It's whatever. It does a lot with what you would want for a Metalocalypse movie to do. I liked the music for this one. And like I said, I'm not much for the screamy death metal stuff where it just sounds like you're just going to wreck your lungs if you're not careful or taking care of them. But I liked the songs that did play.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Brendan Small, not only did he obviously write another Death album, which Nick and I will talk about on our next podcast, but he also composed the score for this movie. And yeah, as Cameron pointed out, it's a pretty good score outside of like the, I think, three or four songs from Death Album 4 that are mentioned in the film. The background music in this is honestly pretty amazing.
Yeah, Brendan Smalls is like a wunderkind in terms of he can voice act, he can sing, he can play music, he can compose music. It's like, what can this guy not do?
And just to add some more awesomeness to this, assisting with the arrangements of the score is Bear McCreary.
Oh yeah, he's great. I thought it was very touching at the very end of the credits that they tribute this film to John Schnepp, who was a director for a majority of the Metalocalypse franchise.
I mentioned this in our Why We Love This Band episode, but Schnepp played a much larger role than even I realized, like when he first kind of came up in the online film community. He not only directed, like, I'd say 95% of the episodes, but he was the one who came up with the like character designs for Death Clock and a lot of the other characters. It's a shame that we lost him before this movie went into production, because if he was still with us now, I bet he would absolutely adore this movie.
I think he'd be happy with the end results. I mean, just the fact that we've gotten an end to this show 10 years after the fact, and it's as good as it is, I think that's just a testament to what they created at the end of the day.
It's a very special show, because a lot of times adult animated series that get canceled after one season or ended abruptly do not get the closure that shows like Venture Brothers and Metalocalypse do. You have to be pretty special, because nobody's going to ask for a return or revival for some of the shows that I can't think off the top of my head that were on Adult Swim that there's no chance for them to come back. They're not going to come back. But Metalocalypse is a special one, just how creative it was and just how it was able to stand out among the rest. And this movie just reinforces why that show was fun to watch and why this movie is very good. It's not in my top 10 or anything like that in terms of animated films. I feel like you could watch this movie on its own, but you're going to be confused. And it's like the Odd Taxi movie. You really can't watch the Odd Taxi movie without watching the show first. And Metalocalypse leans very heavily on the continuity of the show and the special for its emotional payoffs. That's not a criticism. I'm just saying, if you, for some reason, want to check this movie out, watch the show and the special first.
Normally, when like creatives say, oh, this movie was for the fans, it can sometimes come across as like disingenuous, because that movie might be getting thrashed like by the critics. This is one of those rare examples of this movie really is for the fans, because it was pretty much brought into existence by the fans. And I kind of joked about this the first time I saw the movie, but the ending essentially boils down to the real army of the Doomstar was the friends we made along the way.
I mean, that's what it is.
And it wasn't even in any ironic, condescending way. It was just brilliant.
That's the thing. Metalocalypse can be very sincere, but a lot of it had to be juggled with its violence and cynicism, but that was like a product of its time. But a lot of the times, the show is very earnest about its characters and such.
The main thing I'm going to bring up, aside from just like how great the ending is and how it brings everything together, this for me is more of a criticism and less something you might bring up, Cameron. For me, I didn't really find a lot of like the actual Death Clock music tied into the movie the way it did, like the other Death albums tied into episodes of the show. I get it that it's a near hour and a half movie and that you can only fit so much into it, but when you really think about it, a lot of the actual like Death Clock songs don't get a lot of like spotlight in the movie. Gardener of Vengeance gets mentioned in like a line of dialogue where Nathan's like, I only write songs about what your guts will look like liquefied by a weed whacker. Aortic Desecration obviously gets its time to shine when they realize, oh shit, we're playing the wrong song right now. SOS, the Song of Salvation itself, obviously gets plenty of time. And actually, one of my favorite scenes in the movie where they're going after the possessed murder face and that genius reveal that Squizgar subconsciously knows that murder face is possessed by Salacia. And then Toki puts the tuner on the guitar and it's spelling out dead face. Like, that's awesome. That's one of my favorite, like, really creative parts of the movie. But, like, other than that, the other songs on the album, like Mermaider 3, doesn't even get like a prominent part in the movie. I totally thought that it was going to be the song that beats Salacia.
I was kind of hoping that that would be true. I do kind of wish the whales had more of a presence in the film, but as it stands, like, I'll save my thoughts for Death Album 4 for that podcast, but the only criticism I have is that, like you said, that more of it wasn't represented in the movie itself.
And like I said, I feel like they still didn't wrap up too many, like enough of the character dynamics. But I cared more about the story because that's what was more important to me. Like, I guess, like, y'all know the track list for Death Album 4, correct?
Yeah.
Yep.
What would you have, like, are there any songs on there that you would have liked to have seen played in the movie outside of Mermaider 3? Like, I could understand wanting to hear more from that album, but they had to put the best songs on the album, unless you're going to have, like, a spicy hot take of these weren't even the best songs from the album in the movie, but...
Bloodbath, though, is the one that I'm finding a lot of people really like from the album.
Bloodbath is a good one, but the songs that they did pick are great tracks because, again, as we've made pretty clear, Brendan Small is like a musical genius.
And the actual Song of Salvation itself, yeah, that's probably the most uplifting Death Clock song you're probably ever going to hear.
It was great. I think that was my favorite song from the movie. But in general, I very much enjoyed this movie. You definitely have to watch the show to fully get this movie. But if you're down for just death metal epics and what have you, yeah, I would give it a watch still. But again, watch the show first and then the movie.
Nick, your final thoughts before I kind of wrap this up?
The fact that I waited 10 years for this movie to come out, and I'm going to just actually drop this little tidbit of behind the scenes stuff for everybody. We were supposed to do this a week ago, but last week I found out that a childhood friend of mine had passed away. And the only thing that cheered me up last weekend and, you know, made us delay this podcast, I decided either which way, I was going to rewatch the movie because I hadn't watched it enough to prepare for all of this. This thing cheered my gloomy ass up. Like, even after my first initial watch of it, I really loved it to death. I thought it was the best way you could end this show and the best ending we could ask for. Yeah, you technically could make the argument that it does play it safe, but I mean, it is something that is specifically made for people who are already into Metalocalypse as is. And honestly, I can't bitch and complain that much. I know we brought up some of our own personal gripes about it, but other than that, it's mainly just nitpicks. I can't complain that much. The animation looks great. The jokes mainly land for me. A lot of the elements, like Salacia possessing Murderface throughout the movie, that's great. And just the Song of Salvation itself, the final battle at the end of the movie, I can't recommend it enough if you're a fan of this. So I say go pick it up on Blu-ray, especially because you get an awesome poster of it.
Echoing a lot of the thoughts that you two mentioned already, this probably one of the best examples of a movie being for the fans, and they mean it in every single way, from the overall plot to how they compose, like, the music, the animation, like the fight sequences. This whole project, after a decade of waiting, I think was absolutely worth it. So if you are a fan of Metalocalypse, you should definitely check this movie out. Buy it on Blu-ray. Watch the behind-the-scenes features. And if anything about this movie sounds interesting, but you haven't seen the show, you can now stream it on Max. So go watch that and then check out the movie. But
and also don't forget the actual DVD set that I mentioned in our Death Clock episode. Apparently they did fix one. It was a production issue with Doomstar Requiem that it wasn't on the actual, like, complete series DVD set. Apparently that's been fixed.
Oh, great. So yeah, you should definitely pick that up now that you have the complete series.
That's that for this episode.
Cameron, before we go, do you want to quickly tease what we have coming up next?
We got a few things coming up. We still have some Ghibli films we're going to watch. We're going to watch The Inventor, a new stop-motion animated film. And it'll depend on what show we want to talk about next. We might just do a Ghibli film and The Inventor, or we might talk about My Father the Bounty Hunter, or some other cool shows that are out right now.
Awesome. Definitely looking forward to that. And Nick, do you want to tease our next Why We Love This Band?
Yes, considering we wanted to have this out in time for last weekend's Blue Ridge Rock Fest, but unfortunately, if you were there, you were at Blue Ridge Rock Fest, so you kind of played yourself at the end of the day with that. Our next Why We Love This Band is going to be on Job for a Cowboy, especially because they're potentially going to be releasing a new record, either this year or next year. Either which way, you're getting us talking about a band that got its shit together and then decided to just go away.
The journey of that band was an interesting one. I'm definitely looking forward to diving into their full discography, but we will cross that bridge when we get there. For now, before we get out of here, Nick, where can everyone find you online?
Super Saiyan Death Metal God on Instagram. I post mainly album covers, albums I own on vinyl, movies, video games, whatever I tend to be playing mainly at the moment, and just, you know, whatever I tend to just have wrapped up watching. So yeah, if you like seeing nothing but somebody posting their collection nonstop, that's where I am.
And Cameron, where can everyone find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Cam's Eye View. I run my own website called camseyeview.biz, where I review animated films and shows from around the world called The Other Side of Animation. I also have a Patreon at patreon.com/camsideview. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me everywhere on various social media at CaptainK42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Twitter and whatever it's called now, at Ren Pop Culture. You can also find us on YouTube, on Podchaser. Subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/RenegadePopCulture. Listen to all of our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And last but not least, everything can be found at RenegadePopCulture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Nick, take us out.
This movie's Amsnot's Dildos Turkey, and it's because I am the lead's guitarist.